From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hofson's having a well-deserved day off today. I hope you're getting a break as well. It's Here and Now. But no rest for the presidential candidates. Labor Day is when traditionally campaigns vault into a new gear. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are both in Ohio, exactly 3 weeks from the first presidential debate in New York. As expected, Donald Trump spent time this weekend in Detroit at a black church. But was his outreach really about winning over black voters? And does Hillary Clinton have the African-American vote locked up. Let's check in with NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day to you, Robin.
Thank you for your labors. Well, so Trump visited the church. There was the debate beforehand, you know, would he see the congregation? For those who are celebrating their weekend and maybe not paying attention, what happened and what was accomplished? The Washington Post ABC polls for July and August show Trump losing the black vote to Hillary Clinton 9-1.
Well, it was quite the remarkable scene, Robin, a rather ironic scene for many at the Great Faith Ministries Church on Saturday. They have services there on both Saturday and Sunday to accommodate their parishioners. And Donald Trump was grinning and swaying to the church music. We also saw a lot of pictures of him wearing a prayer shawl, something traditional in the Jewish tradition, but also used in some charismatic evangelical churches. And then he spoke for about 12 minutes. He invoked Abraham Lincoln, and he did not stay for the whole service. Then he went with Ben Carson, the former presidential candidate, to Carson's old neighborhood for a picture in front of Carson's boyhood home, where the current occupant actually told NPR's Sam Sanders that she's voting for Hillary Clinton. But, you know, Donald Trump knows he's not going to get a lot of black votes in swing states. He needs to get at least some. And it's important to be seen pursuing those votes because it matters to some of the white voters who are not with Trump now, especially suburban white women.
Yeah. Well, how about Hillary Clinton? You say not with Trump. Are they all with Hillary Clinton, meaning the African-Americans, especially young black voters?
They're not all with her. And they weren't during the primaries. Many younger black voters liked Bernie Sanders, or they stayed home. They're not enthusiastic about her. They don't share the sense of history with her from the 1990s that perhaps their parents and grandparents do. And they just have a lot of questions about what she stands for and whether she truly stands with them. So they're not enthusiastic. That doesn't make them Trump voters. It doesn't necessarily make them voters, though. So she needs them to turn out, and she's going to have to do some work to make that happen.
Well, and briefly, where are we with Donald Trump and immigration reform after his comments last week for and against softening his stance? On the same day, the comments, his running mate Mike Pence was on Meet the Press yesterday and had a long exchange on immigration with Chuck Todd. Here's just a little.
As I travel across this country campaigning with Donald Trump and for Donald Trump, I think people hear him loud and clear, and he's been completely consistent on this point.
No, he's not.
Illegal
he
had immigration deportation at the very center of the national debate.
But he has not been consistent on this issue, what to do with the 11 to 15 million.
Well, there are people in different circumstances in that category.
And Ron Elving, this continued with another Trump surrogate, Rudy Giuliani, saying, oh, Donald Trump would never deport a family. So do we have clarity?
No. And if anything, last week pretty much established that the lack of clarity, the ambivalence on this issue is just going to be permanent. He says he wants a wall. Mexico has to pay for it. Mexico says it won't. So will there be a wall? And all the criminals have to leave, Donald Trump says. But the rest of the 11 million, well, they're subject to deportation, which is, of course, the ultimate wiggle room answer that politicians have been using for years. And the only real answer would have to come if and when Donald Trump were actually president.
Yeah. So here we are, 3 weeks from the first debate, and maybe it'll come up a lot then as well. But we're told at this point in the campaign we should look at the battleground states for polling and look at independents as opposed to, you know, everybody else who's hard locked on either side. Both Clinton and Trump are in Cleveland today. Bring us up to speed on how the candidates are polling in Ohio and the battleground states.
Okay, let's talk about Ohio first. That's been very close all through August. It's a point up or two in one poll, a point the other way in another poll. So I don't think Ohio is going to be clear, probably right up to the election itself. But the battleground states also include Florida, Iowa, Nevada, of course, where the polls have been very close as well, essentially tied or within the margin of error in the last week. Hillary Clinton had an advantage in Florida. That seems to have largely dissipated. But she does seem to have a more durable lead, at least a small lead, on Trump in some of the other battleground states. That would include Pennsylvania, Virginia, New Hampshire, where it's a pretty good-sized lead, North Carolina, quite narrow, and Colorado, where they're beginning to look like they're going to be in the Democratic column.
Clinton may have a lead. Is she going to have a press conference? Hillary Clinton debuted that new campaign plane today, and it's got the traveling press on it. And so we're hearing from her coming down the aisle and speaking to the guys in the back of the bus, so to speak, the flying bus. But it was, you know, chit-chat, you know, hi, how are you? Haven't seen you in a while kind of thing. Talk about whether, you know, the pressure on her to have a press conference.
Yeah, she said, welcome to our new big plane. She will not probably have a traditional press conference. She is going to try to continue to get around that by having one-on-one meetings or the equivalent with various different news organizations and maybe talk to people in smaller groups. If she uses this airplane as an opportunity to actually go back and schmooze with the reporters and spend some quality time with them, then it will certainly have been a worthwhile investment for her. But she's probably not going to give up.
Right. Ronell, we have to ask you quickly. Today, the president at the end of the G20 summit was asked about Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco 49ers quarterback, who has been refusing to stand for the national anthem as a protest against the way blacks are treated. What did the president say?
The president said that this was part of a long tradition of well-known athletes taking controversial positions on issues about race and about a lot of other things in American life. He said he was sympathetic with what Colin Kaepernick has been trying to do, but distanced himself somewhat from the exact method.
It was such an odd moment, this international moment in China, but there it was. Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
So it's Labor Day, college students settling in. A prominent Harvard professor is posing a provocative question as they do. Given that many students are not active enough for their health, should the school impose a phys ed requirement on them? Carrie Goldberg of Here and Now contributor WBUR takes a look.
Harvard professor Daniel Lieberman studies how the human body evolved. He's best known for his starring role in the book Born to Run, about how well-suited we are for endurance running. But he also says we're hardwired to avoid exercise.
It's completely normal and natural to avoid unnecessary physical activity. I mean, that's an adaptation.
Trouble is, it was an adaptation to an environment of scarce food that forced humans to hunt and gather for miles, not to an environment of, say, university dining hall buffets. So Lieberman is proposing a campus discussion on whether Harvard should revive its phys ed requirement from before the Vietnam War era. He says he knows he may be starting a firestorm, that students might see a requirement as coercive. But, he argues, the university requires students to do all sorts of things for their own good. Think, study, take tests.
And so the question that we need to ask ourselves is, should we treat the body any differently than the mind? And I would argue that, you know, we're here for the student as a whole. And furthermore, there's, I think, a false division between the mind and the body. And the two are intrinsically related, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise.
If Harvard does bring back the phys ed requirement, that may help turn a tide that's long been running in the other direction, says Professor Brad Cardinal of Oregon State University. He published a study in 2013 that found a very different picture of physical education than back in the 1920s, when almost all American universities had phys ed requirements.
We found that right now we're at a all-time low for the physical education requirement, with just under 40% of institutions across the country offering a physical education requirement to graduate with a university or college degree.
Today, many colleges and universities have some of the most palatial gyms around, so administrators may feel their students' needs are met. But chances are they're not. Cardinal says less than half of American university students get as much physical activity as the basic national guidelines say they should. Surveys cited in Harvard Magazine find about one quarter of students at Harvard are not really active at all. On the brick sidewalk outside her Harvard dorm, sophomore Molly Levin says, yes, it's hard for some students to get enough exercise. The trouble is finding time and energy in a demanding academic environment.
It's like the easiest thing to push off because you're like, oh, I'll just exercise tomorrow. And when you're already exhausted, then the last thing you want to do is use more energy up.
Personally, she would support a phys ed requirement, but
I also know that there'd be a lot of backlash. It'd be very controversial. So I don't know if it would ever, go through. But I personally think it's a great idea. But like, I just came from the gym.
So what might a Harvard phys ed requirement look like? Could you just submit your Fitbit or your Pokemon Go data? Daniel Lieberman says that's all open to discussion. He favors the honor system and that any form of physical activity could count, from intramural sports to climbing stairs. His main point?
We can signal the university's desire to help encourage physical activity and, you know, find ways to prescribe it, nudge, push, maybe shove students in some way that's mutually acceptable, because obviously we're not going to do this unless the students buy in as well.
Lieberman says committee discussion of the idea of a phys ed requirement at Harvard has begun. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Our next conversation may not be suitable for many young ears, but it's stuff middle schoolers hear all the time. And it's in a conversation we thought we'd revisit as they head back to school, a place where girls in particular have to navigate a Hunger Games-like gauntlet, their reputations ruined at the drop of a rumor. When Emily Linden was in middle school in the late 1990s, she had an encounter with a boy, some touching, but she was called a slut, and it stuck. But she kept diaries, and when she was 27, dug them out to become the basis for Unslut, a diary and a memoir, and also for the Unslut Project, helping others get through slut shaming. We spoke to Emily about the website and her book last January. And we should say that you are not Emily, that Emily Linden isn't your real name. You adopted it and changed the names in your diary. So what, you could protect people you went to school with?
Yeah, I published these diaries online first, and I realized that if I were changing everyone else's names to protect them, I needed to change my own as well. So Emily Linden is a pen name, and I'm really glad I use it. The book's purpose isn't to humiliate anyone who bullied me when they were preteens or to even really expose them. I really hope that most people who come up in the book recognize that. And the feedback I've gotten so far from people who've recognized themselves despite the name changes has been really positive.
Tell us who you were. This young Emily, for one thing, you were physically advanced.
Right. I had developed breasts before most girls in my grade, and I was the first to get my period, as far as I know, when I was 10. So I had a lot of attention already just because of the way my body looked. Boys and girls were interested in my womanly figure versus what a lot of my classmates' bodies looked like. And I was going through puberty, so I was attracted to boys and flirting with them and just discovering this new feminine, you know, power that I had. And I had a crush on this boy whose name I've changed to Zach. Mm-hmm. And he reciprocated eventually, and I thought I was in love. I mean, I was 11, 12, 13 years old, and I would have done anything he asked me to. And one of those things was to go to third base, as we called it, which is basically just he put his hands down my pants.
Which is not the sex act itself. And yet, bam, that ricochets around school, and that's it. That's it for you. You're a slut.
Right. I mean, it was so easy back then for a rumor to completely derail all my friendships, and I blamed those rumors for really ruining my reputation. But nowadays, it's even easier for just one tweet or one photo that's shared without consent or indiscriminately to ruin someone's life. And in my case, I really internalized that. I thought all I was how my classmates defined me, which was a slut.
Yeah, well, and even your friends who might cheerfully say to you, well, you know, they're saying you're a slut. Here's another part of the book where somebody said to you, oh, you're such a tease, because you're not putting out, you know, for someone. And then you're blaming yourself for being a tease, for not following through on your false reputation as a slut.
That's when it becomes really dangerous, is when we kind of buy into this. And most of us as young women, as preteens, teenagers, and actually many of us as adult women find it hard to escape that dichotomy. Either you, quote, put out, or you don't. And in that case, like you said, people might tell you you're a tease. And if you've been told this enough, and if you've been convinced that really what your friends say about you is true, then it's really easy to believe that. And that's when it becomes dangerous, because that's when girls often turn to self-harm, as I did, or consider taking their own lives, as I did.
Well, that was quite shocking to come across towards the end of the book, when your younger self does take a razor to your wrists. Because for much of the book, you've been trying to play. It feels like, and in your comments in the margin, you do note that much of the time it feels like you're trying to play a part. You even maybe quote from TV shows, things that you realize now, I didn't know about that. So even though this is a diary, and for a long time anonymous, you see your young self trying to live up to something.
As anyone knows who's ever tried to keep a diary or journaled to get through something that's difficult, it can be a really useful coping mechanism. But I also used it to convince myself in some entries that things weren't as bad as I was experiencing them, or that I was in control in ways that I clearly wasn't. So that's why it was so important to me to add this commentary so that people aren't reading this middle school girl's diary just at face value.
Yeah. Here's a couple of lines. At one point you talk about, this is I think in the basement with Zach. He tried to get his hand up my shirt. He was stronger. Finally, I gave in. There's another point where you're at a school dance with Matt and he starts to touch you inappropriately and you describe the younger you. These are the words of a younger person. You describe your body just freezing because you just don't know what to do. I mean, for those who would say, oh, come on, why didn't you just say no? There's a lot revealed in your diaries about why a young girl can't sometimes just say no.
It's so frustrating to me. In all conversations when we're talking about female sexuality, and especially when we're talking about sexual assault and consent, there's this reaction that, well, if it was really that bad, you should have told someone. Or if it was really that bad, you should have gone to the police. Or why didn't you blank, basically? And judging the person who was the target of the bullying or the victim of the sexual assault for not acting like a perfect victim, whatever that looks like, or for not acting in ways that we think if we were in that situation, we would have.
Well, because these were all popular kids. These were your friends. You wanted to be a part of. I mean, I would imagine if without this group of friends, and it was pretty extensive, then you're an isolated kid.
Exactly. At that age, you don't have the perspective to recognize that the people upon whose opinions you're hanging your identity, those people don't need to matter in a few years, let alone when you're an adult.
There's so much here. You talk about other girls. There's one entry here where you're saying about another girl, I knew that those boys were going to do that to her because they got sick of her poser slut act and now it's annoying. I told her this would happen. And then in the margin you write, I'm so disturbed that I remove all the blame from the boys. That happens a lot, that you write in the margins. I can't believe I blame myself instead of the boys, some of whom have reached out to you.
Right. And I'll give a shout out to the boy whose name I changed to Tyler, who's a great guy, who apologized. He contributed to a crowdfunding campaign I was doing for a related film to show his support. He has a Define Slut t-shirt, which we sell online. He's really on board. And he said reading through my diaries opened his eyes. And I hope that it will do the same for other straight guys who might not have any need to think about slut shaming or how it affects the girls in their lives and the women who have to suffer through it daily.
It's interesting. There's a young woman I adore who went through something like that. And I didn't know about your project, but unslut is the perfect way to put it. You can seize back who you think you are. And it's interesting because you're talking not just about girls who maybe didn't do anything and or maybe did a couple of little things and then the rumors started and there they get the label. But you also say, wait a minute, why can't young women be as adventurous as men if they want to without being called a slut? The way young men aren't called promiscuous if they participate and enjoy it.
Almost every woman I speak to about this project either went through something similar herself at some point in her life, or one of her friends did, or she knows that girl who had that rumor spread about her in high school. Yet there's also this sense of complacency almost. Well, that's just the way it's always been. It's that way for girls. It's not that way for boys. And that's so unfair. And I think it's such a perfect time now when we have the ability to examine some things about gender fluidity and about sexuality in general and the layer that social media and publicity adds to that.
Much of what happened to you was good old-fashioned rumors and parents' landline phones, people talking on the phone all night. Then, of course, the internet does come along and you turn on one day and there's somebody with the screen name Di Emily Linden, who turned out to be a girlfriend of yours, who wrote, why don't you just kill yourself? How old were you at that point?
At that time, I was 12, I think, 11 or 12.
What did it feel like in your late 20s to be reminded to read that you tried to kill yourself?
It was jarring to me, but I knew that I had done that. when I heard about girls who had been committing suicide because of going through something similar in recent years, that was where it really resonated, where I thought, I almost did that too. And it was an obligation almost to then share my story.
Well, and also your happy ending, which kids should hear. Because in high school, you discovered your incredible voice, became known for your musical theater talent, had a nice boyfriend. Things can change.
Right. And there's no way to know that. I think that's what I'm really hoping that this book will do, will provide solidarity and comfort to realize that it can get better, that they can make their lives better and they can redefine themselves. I want it to be a catalyst for overcoming this definition of oneself.
Yeah. Well, you also might prompt other phone calls being made from people of all different ages back to somebody in high school or middle school to apologize.
Yeah. Well, I was terrible to my peers as well. Even though I was being sexually bullied daily, I turned around and bullied other people, and I sexually bullied other people. I called other girls sluts. And it's not like I was going out of my way to be awful. It was just normal. I was participating in this normal, toxic type of interactions that many of us have as preteens and as adolescents and honestly as adults as well.
That's Emily Linden, or the name she's taken to publish her diary and memoir of being labeled a slut. It's called Unslut. We'll link you to the web project as well. Emily, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Some people at home are taking a break from their labors this Labor Day. There are also people wishing they could. They're searching for jobs. And there are retired Americans looking back on a life of labor. But our next guest says, well, maybe you should still be working. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. And Jill, you say work past retirement age, for which people call you a buzzkiller. Make your case.
Well, first of all, I admit that I am a buzzkill for so many reasons. But, you know, and when I was a financial advisor for almost 15 years, I would consistently look at people's retirement plans and I would see the benefit financially of working longer. And it just seemed so silly. Like, people are healthy and happy when they're in their 60s. It's not your grandmother's 65. Why everyone was so compelled to leave their jobs, it just drove me nuts. Well, recently, more and more, we see people who are over the age of 65, they're working. And they're working mostly because the financial crisis really was tough on them.
The recession,
so,
yeah.
Absolutely, right? So we know that, you know, about 18.8% of older Americans are either working full or part-time. But, you know, we've seen surveys that people are saying, one of the reasons I work, it's not just to make money. About a third of people say they are working because they enjoy their jobs and they want to stay involved. And we've seen some reports that also say that about half the people who retire say, I'm actually not really satisfied in my retirement years.
This is a study from the Employee Benefit Research Institute. They say more than half of the respondents said retirement was just, you know, sort of satisfying. And so let's take this apart. You talk about, as a financial planner, you want people to work longer so they have more for retirement. We've gone over the dismal retirement funds that most Americans have. They don't have money saved. But what about people who work in very physical jobs, construction, trucking? They cannot, you know, they are pushing themselves to the limit to hold on to their jobs to retirement age.
I absolutely understand that. You know, I had a dad who is a trader on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. And so he would say, you know, I stand on my feet all day. Or as you say, a physical laborer, you can't do it. But what we have seen is that a lot of those people may choose to do different things in retirement. And that could be anything from the tried and true, hey, I'm working as a greeter in a retail store, or I'm volunteering in some way. And there is some fascinating research from Oregon State University that says working past age 65 actually leads to longer lives.
That study from Oregon, you write, it's not just that working longer leads to longer life. They have to underscore that by saying retiring early may be a risk factor for dying.
I know. And it doesn't matter whether you're actually healthy or unhealthy coming into retirement. It, for both groups, it turns out that that's the case. Now, look, I have talked about this a lot, and I've gotten some people who say to me, like, I hated my job. Don't tell me I have to be chained to my desk. That can't be healthy for me. Okay. I'm just saying, figure out a way to stay involved. And that can be membership in a social group. It can be your book club. It can be a religious organization. You know, I think that as we live longer and not just have to grapple with the financial concerns. We have to live longer and really stay engaged intellectually, emotionally, and that does lead to better health outcomes. So all in all, I'm going to stand by working longer. I don't care if I'm a buzzkill.
So everybody, back to work. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day to you.
And again, now that we've killed your retirement buzz, happy Labor Day. This coming Sunday will mark the 15th anniversary of 9/11. All this week, we'll hear voices reflecting on that nightmare day when 19 followers of Osama bin Laden boarded four planes and crashed them into the Pentagon, a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and New York's World Trade Towers. We'll hear from someone who survived the tower's fall, someone who lost a loved one in them, and today, a Muslim American. Now, when we look back at our coverage of the first anniversary in 2002, we were reminded that then-President George Bush was at the UN that week, making his case for war with Iraq. New Yorkers outside chanting, "Not in our name." Since then, Al-Qaeda has given birth to ISIS. How does one Muslim American reflect on the last 15 years? Linda Sarsour was born in Brooklyn to Palestinian immigrants. She's the executive director of the Arab American Association of New York and joins us by Skype. Linda, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Well, until last Friday, we understand there was additional anxiety because it was thought that a Muslim holy day would fall on 9/11.
Yes, I'm very grateful that that's not happening. Eid will be on Monday, September 12th, where the New York City public school system will also be recognizing those days.
Yeah, many school systems have that day off. Eid, a high holy day in the Muslim world. And the way it's determined is by a sighting of a new moon a certain amount of days before the holiday. And so, you know, people were very nervous up until this was determined this past Friday by leaders of the faith in Saudi Arabia. But why? What were you worried about?
I mean, I personally was encouraging my community to continue to celebrate Eid as any other year because Muslims deserve to be unapologetically Muslim in America and the land of religious freedom. But our community was worried about people saying that we were celebrating the horrific attacks of 9/11 15 years later. And we have already seen that happen. I mean, Donald Trump has taken many opportunities to say that on 9/11, that Muslims in places like New Jersey were celebrating, well, that was absolutely false and untrue, but people took it as fact. So people were worried about that. They were worried also about gathering in large groups, you know, outdoors and, you know, thinking about some of the recent acts of violence that maybe someone can come and incite some sort of violence against Muslims.
Well, and there have been recent attacks. There was an imam and his assistant assassinated, shot in the head in broad daylight in Queens. A non-Muslim has been arrested. And more recently, a woman was killed?
Yes, a woman from Bangladesh, 60-year-old Nazma Khanum, was stabbed to death walking home from work.
Yeah. So there was already a chill in the air. You were concerned that people would see you as celebrating on this somber, sacred day. Do you remember where you were on 9/11 15 years ago?
15 years ago, I was a college student at Kingsborough Community College in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. And my college professor was a very strict man who didn't allow us to use any type of electronics. But that morning, he answered his cell phone, which really made us uneasy. And he left the classroom and never came back. And when we walked out onto our college campus, it's right across from Manhattan, and we walked out to literally almost a shower of burned paper. And we were still confused and didn't know what happened. But I found out exactly what had happened when I got to my mother's house, where my mother was leaving to pick up my little brother from school. And my mother wasn't wearing her hijab. She was leaving the house, you know, with her hair uncovered. And I said, "Where are you going? You don't have your hijab on." And she said, "We can't wear it right now." And I was like, "What is this lady talking about?" Until I went inside and I sat down in front of the TV and I knew exactly what she was talking about.
What did you think when you heard that this horrific attack was done in the name of your faith?
At that moment, as a New Yorker, as someone who was born and raised in Brooklyn, I was already horrified at the act that happened. I was horrified by watching the images of people jumping out of buildings and all of the, you know, chaos that we saw and the loved ones crying over those that they lost. And then on top of that, I was horrified and scared for the backlash that was going to happen, because all I heard was Muslims, terror, Muslims, Islam, terror. And it was really a very hard time to think about that moment and who you were and how your Islam became kind of your frontline identity.
No. Did you know anyone who died?
I knew Salman Hamdani, who's the son of Talat Hamdani. He was actually an NYPD EMT who chose to go directly to be a rescue worker. And he actually died in the first few days after 9/11 as a rescue worker. But the media and the headlines connected Salman Hamdani as potentially somehow connected to the act of terrorism while he was an American hero. And that really made me realize that that's it. Even when we are helping our fellow New Yorkers, even when we are being whole Americans, that we are going to be somehow connected to this act until he was vindicated only months later.
Look, what do you make of what's happened since this mushrooming of a group determined in, again, in the name of your faith? It's a hijacking of your faith, a corruption of your faith, but in the name of your faith, attacking the West, attacking Muslims as well. But what do you make of what's happened?
You know, Muslims are the largest victims of ISIS. And we didn't hear about ISIS 5 years ago. And I want people to understand that we cannot have a conversation just about ideology, that this is an ideological war between us and ISIS. And I think we have to understand that our foreign policy and the choices that we have made, including the war in Iraq, has created a breeding ground for these extremist and violent groups who target Muslims more than they target any other group.
What have you seen? Have you seen people, you know, maybe shy away from the faith, not to be associated with that day, embrace it more fully? What have you seen?
I mean, I've seen a spectrum. I've seen people become more religious and more connected to faith, believing that that is the only hope that we have as Muslim Americans living in America right now, 15 years after 9/11. I've seen women take off their hijab, feeling that their hijab was almost somehow impacting their security, that they weren't feeling safe wearing it, especially if people worked in the evenings or if they went to college and took night classes. For me personally, you know, as someone who is a nonprofit leader, is a community activist, is an organizer, I have chosen to be unapologetically Muslim. I've chosen to be a role model for young Muslim Americans. I was born and raised here. I deserve to be Muslim in this country. I have the right to be Muslim in this country. And I've chosen that. And it's not always easy. I personally have been attacked by the right wing. I have personally received death threats. I have personally received emails of people that are so hateful, that don't know anything about me, don't know me personally, but just the virtue of my faith, the virtue of me speaking out and saying that my community deserves to live with dignity and respect and in safety, has caused people to threaten my life. 15 years after 9/11 is way worse than even weeks and months and even the first few years after 9/11. And that really is what, for me, is the phenomenon, that this horrific act happened 15 years ago, that 3,000 of our fellow Americans died on that day. And 15 years later, not only have we not healed as a nation, but actually the backlash against Muslim has increased in the recent years.
And I just have to ask you, two Americans who say, well, there have been horrific attacks by Muslims in Orlando, you know, elsewhere. What do you say to them?
I say to my fellow Americans that we never put the responsibility on any other community when people and members of those communities commit acts of violence. You know, we've had mass shootings in this country, including at Planned Parenthood. We had a young white man who went into a church and massacred 9 black parishioners. We had a white man walk into a gurdwara and assassinate Sikh Americans, some of the most peaceful people in the world. And we never ask our fellow Christians or our fellow white Americans to stand up and condemn this type of violence. And for me, I want to condemn violence because I'm a human being. I don't want to condemn violence because I'm Muslim. And I think it's not fair to our young people that they continue to see leaders in the Muslim community apologizing for acts of violence that have absolutely nothing to do with our community. And if we continue to be in this particular mindset and marginalize Muslim Americans, what we need is for Muslim Americans to be integrated into the larger American society, because we are part of this country.
Linda Sarsour, Executive Director of the Arab American Association of New York. Linda, thank you.
Thank you.
And she mentioned the backlash against Muslims. There are reports of slurs flung at Muslim kids on football teams, attacks on mosques. In 2014, a man was arrested and charged with a hate crime after throwing a trash can at Linda and a colleague and chasing them, threatening to cut off their heads. Well, Linda's plans for 9/11 this year on the 15th anniversary, she'll attend prayer services for the victims of 9/11 on Sunday, and the next day on Eid, attend more prayer services and then celebrate her faith. This coming weekend, chefs and ecologists will gather on Appledore Island off the coast of New Hampshire for the eco-culinary retreat Take a Bite Out of Appledore. It's a way to try to show how invasive species, plants, and sea life that are sometimes thought of as pests can be good eating. You hear the word eating there. That means that here now resident chef Kathy Gunst might have been involved. And yes, she checked out last year's Take a Bite Out of Appledore and joins us in the studio with more. I never heard of this. Hi, Kathy.
It's brand new. It was the first year last year. This will be the second year. And it is a fabulous weekend.
Yeah, tell us more. What happens?
Take a Bite Out of Appledore was conceived by Evan Mallett, who's the chef and owner of the Black Trumpet in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. A woman named Jen Seavey, who's the director of the Shoals Marine Laboratory on Appledore. And Sam Hayward, the chef and owner of 4th Street in Portland. And the goal was to educate people about the island and its history, but also about the number of invasive and non-native species on and around the island.
Right. And, you know, I first heard it Appledore, I thought it was like Harry Potter or something, you know. But you do get a little into that kind of mysterious land when you talk about these invasive species.
It is mysterious and spectacular out there. Let me paint a little picture for you. So cue the seagulls. There they are. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of them out in Appledore. It's only a 45-minute boat ride from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, but it's a world away. Whales and dolphins are regularly sighted in the waters, and it's part of the chain of islands known as the Isle of Shoals, which many tourists go to, again, out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So we arrived last August, and almost immediately when we got there, we were told, put on your bathing suits because we're going on an aquatic foraging expedition to find invasive species that would be used and cooked for the dinner that night. So Evan Mallett gave us our marching orders.
We're going to be looking for green crabs, which is an invasive species that increased significantly in the Gulf of Maine until fairly recently. We're also looking for periwinkles, an invasive that's been around here for a very long time, and they make delicious food. So hopefully we're going to have our crack team digging up some periwinkles and green crabs.
So about 12 of us put on snorkel and masks and fins, and we went into that ice cold water. People think the water in Maine is cold. Try going out to the Isle of Shoals. It's really cold.
Okay.
And we did indeed find those green crabs and tons of periwinkles.
Periwinkles.
They look like snails and they actually taste like them. We also found all kinds of edible seaweed like sugar kelp. It was pretty exciting.
Okay. So that's the water. What about the land?
Even though Appledore is 7 miles from shore, invasive species have also made it onto the land. And John Forty, a master gardener at the Massachusetts Horticulture Society, led a small group of us around the 95-acre island to show us how plants we thought were weeds are also edible and delicious. So we found wild sorrel, wild mint, Indian tobacco, goldenrod, and then John Forty got very excited because he found purslane, a plant that has a lot of history and very good health benefits.
It has a lot of omegas in it. It's got a lot of calcium, and it's delicious. The early colonists would pickle the stalks of it and then eat the leaves fresh on salad. It's very crispy, kind of mucilaginous on the inside, and it has a faint lemony flavor to it.
Mucilaginous, though, Kathy. That does not sound good.
It sounds completely gross, and it became a big joke that weekend because so many of the plants on Appledore were referred to as having mucilage, which was a word that I found very funny. It's actually a thick, kind of gooey substance, and it plays a role in the storage of water and food and seed germination. But it turns out a lot of plants on Appledore have a mucilaginous texture.
Okay. And by the way, we'll have pictures of these plants, too.
Yeah, but the chefs, Sam Hayward and Evan Mallett just did amazing things to transform these plants into really interesting dishes.
What kind?
We feasted on green crab wings with chili aioli, periwinkles, which I swear tasted like French snails, a gorgeous Asian seaweed salad made with the harvested sugar kelp, and the most incredible tamales, where they used the harvested seaweed as the wrapper instead of corn husks, and they filled it with local lobster. It was a spectacular meal, and one that might have ended up in the garbage pail if we hadn't learned how delicious these invasive foods can be.
Well, is that the point, to, as long as they're here, to eat them or to reduce them by eating them? And what's the point?
The purpose of the weekend was not just to show off these great chefs and what they could do. It was to try to change the way that people think about these foods. I mean, we certainly have a crisis in our fisheries. There are many species that have been overfished. And the people who put together the weekend on Appledore are really hoping that some of these foods that we've thought of as inedible will start showing up in our markets, in our kitchens, in our restaurants, to take the pressure off of the species that are so threatened. So it's all about looking at the edible foods that grow near us in a different light.
Oh, fabulous. I hear now resident chef Kathy Gunst talking about the Bite Out of Appledore Eco-Culinary Retreat. To find out more, to see pictures of the retreat that Kathy went on last year, or even to, let's give you a couple of Evan Mallett's recipes. I mean, who doesn't want to eat a mucilaginous leafy thing?
You make it sound so sexy.
Go to hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Jeremy's back tomorrow. Have a great Labor Day and join us then. Here and Now.